I'm Colleen Luckett. Welcome to EDUCAUSE Now.
And I'm Jerry Bain. Accessibility for students is an important part of providing equality to everyone who would like an education. But it's especially imperative to discuss accessibility with the emergence of web-based distance learning and the use of social media in the classroom.
Coming up later in the program, we'll hear about accessibility issues specific to higher education from Joe Wheaton, Associate Professor and Faculty Liaison for the Web Accessibility Center and Coordinator for the Special Education Program at The Ohio State University.
EDUCAUSE recently announced the winners of its 2009 Leadership and Catalyst Awards. Through these annual awards, EDUCAUSE recognizes outstanding leaders, innovations, and initiatives in higher education IT. Julie Little, Director of Teaching, Learning, and Professional Development, will tell you more about the recipients in her commentary.
What factors contribute to faculty adoption of new social media tools for teaching and learning? And what are the implications of these practices for effective pedagogy? We asked several higher education professionals with a focus on social media to participate in a roundtable discussion. Joining us at the table is Jeff Nugent, Associate Director for the Center of Teaching Excellence at Virginia Commonwealth University, Patricia Kahn, Director of Technology Training and Integration for Montclair State University, Virginia Kuhn, Associate Director of the Institute for Multimedia Literacy at the University of Southern California, and Brian Alexander, Director for Research at the National Institute for Technology and Liberal Education, or NITELY.
Jeff Nugent started off the discussion by commenting on the digital native, digital immigrant dichotomy.
As we talk about expectations and assumptions and this idea of tech savviness, I think it's that conversation that some folks adhere to and say, well, students already kind of have this stuff. They buy into the digital native, digital immigrant kind of thing. And so they don't see as necessary engaging in this conversation about critical literacy. I think it's important to recognize that.
I agree. I see that happen a lot. Why does that happen? Why do academics decide to stop thinking through that problem?
I'm not sure. I think because, one, it's kind of complex, nuanced, and to really get at it requires a significant shift in your own thinking. Mm-hmm. And to do that requires time and mental energy, and it's easier to kind of dismiss so I can go on about my work.
Henry Jenkins often makes that point that by having that distinction between a digital native, that allows adults to just sign off and go, well, I'm not part of that group, so therefore I have no, I don't have to mess my hands with it.
But it's really interesting that we have this weird habit in American culture, and I can't find other countries that do the same thing, where we bifurcate our attitudes for technology. I mean, there's a kind of stereotype of the anti-technologist who is wearing glasses or is on prescription drugs or is driving a car, right? I mean, we don't think about cars as technology. I mean, if you ask someone, of course they'll think of it, but they don't do this. I mean, print is a technology.
Right.
Blackboards are a technology. And we naturalize these things. Another part of this is that we don't see these discussions happening in professional societies enough. We don't see these happening in the public sphere often enough. We're not going to see from the Department of Education. We're not going to see in the K-12 world. And
And I agree. And I think one of the things about the whole tech savviness argument is that it's a disservice to that conversation.
Right.
This stuff out here on the new mediascape. 4 years old. We're all figuring out what's going on here.
Do you have the IT's utility discussion on campus?
That's, I think, an administrative, perhaps, view of IT as service. So the only critical view we take of it is when it's not working.
Right.
Right.
In my mind, I think technology has to work in a classroom as if you walk into a room and turn on a switch. It has to be just present and you don't even realize that you're using it, and you don't even realize when you walked in the room that you turned on the switch and light came on. It's just part of your life. And until you reach that point where technology has become that part of your life where it's simple, easy, and it's just there, there's always going to be these stumbling blocks that we have to, overcome.
Point.
But at the same point, technology changes so often. So I don't know if we ever will reach that time in our life where it will be as simple as turning on a switch.
Well, and I kind of, in a lot of ways, hope not, because the thing is that emergent technologies, we're in the throes right now, and so I think it's our sort of duty to shape the tools as they develop, and so I think even if we're transforming through use, the more transparent or the more naturalized it gets, the more it lets people off the hook and lets them not sort of think about it critically. But the thing that worries me about this sort of rhetoric that we're hearing about students and having no tech savviness is it's going to be that same, you know, students today, kids today, no attention span, can't write a sentence, they're stupid. And, you know, that argument is as old as sort of Aristotle. It's just really old, you know.
It's old, and it seems to persist in being kind of anti-intellectual. I would come back to another piece of this, Jerry, which is interesting.
Academics who use social media as platforms for being a public intellectual. So rather than having to win a book from a popular press, which still happens, or a TV show like, say, Carl Sagan, now we have academics who want to share their passion with the world through the blogosphere or through podcasts. There's two sides to this. I mean, for me, one is the side that worries me is that we're not celebrating these guys often enough. And in fact, academia does have a tradition of actually biting public intellectuals. There's still scientists who still hate Carl Sagan, for example.
Right.
But do we teach students to do this? Do we teach students to celebrate these guys or find them? In K-12, you say, check out some of these podcasts. These are really amazing. The positive side is we have faculty who more or less bypass higher education in a lot of ways and set up stuff on their own. And they get involved in these large enterprises. I mean, this is something to celebrate that wasn't happening 4 years ago, more like 10 years ago.
What's the driver then to generate this as a meaningful conversation in higher education? How is it that we're going to get attention enough to be able to have this kind of talk happen in the places where it needs to happen? Because I don't see that, and I'm not seeing that. And don't get me wrong here, I value incredibly my virtual network of folks that contribute to my own learning here. But it sounded a little bit like an echo chamber these days. And I'm wondering about how we get faculty to even consider this to be an important question to ask. And my fear is that this whole thing unfolds at such a rapid pace that we're constantly playing catch up to it. And at what point does it outstrip our capacity to catch up? And is that the tipping point?
I'll offer six answers and then see what my colleagues, who I keep abusing by running over them, let them say something smarter. One is active participation in Web 2.0, and we have to make sure that we do that. The second part is working professional groups, professional associations of publishers, but also different disciplines, you know, language teachers, biologists, and so on. That's a major, major peer group. Also professional media. There are also public media journals that are extremely important for us. NPR. We need to get better coverage in NPR, because that's for higher education, I think, the most single widely consumed medium we've got. And I would say technology media, talking to the tech press, people like IT Conversations, and less collaborations. I mean, my whole network, this is something we do in every campus, trying to get people talking at all levels, from dean to faculty to librarian about this. To be able to hear the same conversation in multiple colleges is very useful.
And to hear it from their peers, to say that it works, and this is, I can prove to you that it works, and I've done enough research, and I've used this technology enough times where look at the improvement of learning that I'm demonstrating, that my students have demonstrated over the years because of this technology.
Yep.
They want to see facts.
What would you say is the takeaway in terms of where social media stands right now? What's the most problematic thing you see?
As technology evolves, it threatens to attenuate the lines of communication. I mean, I think we need the humanist element, and we can't forget that we're connecting human beings. And so I think that social media ought to be used in a way that fosters community, both virtual and actually real.
And to add to that, the consideration of learning styles, I think, is a crucial component that you can't forget. Not everybody learns the same way, and you need to have alternative methods available.
It's kind of a hope that I have that's also a challenge, I think, is that these tools mean nothing in and of themselves. It's how they're used. For me, teaching and learning is about relationships and building communities. If social media does nothing more than raise the question about, wow, how do I build a community in my classroom? That folks have the opportunity to do that in a way that they emerge with a sense that, wow, it's just really helped to build community. For me, that's what it comes down to. That's like the hugest challenge, I think, at this point.
Jeff Nugent, Patricia Kahn, Virginia Kuhn, and Brian Alexander. This is Julie Little with EDUCAUSE, and it is my pleasure to share with you the Association's top awards, the 2009 EDUCAUSE Leadership Award, and the 2009 EDUCAUSE Catalyst Award. Through peer endorsement, these annual awards recognize outstanding leaders, innovations, and initiatives in higher education IT. The EDUCAUSE Leadership Award acknowledges and celebrates leadership from those whose work has had significant positive impact on the contributions of information technology to higher education. For the first time, EDUCAUSE grants its highest honor to a collective winner, the Seminars on Academic Computing, more fondly known as SAC. For mentoring and cultivating a generation of leaders across the IT profession, held annually from 1970 through 2007, SAC was more than an event. It was an experience that fostered dialogue around shared knowledge and developed a community of practitioners who today serve and advance information technology within higher education. In 1968, the National Science Foundation concluded that most of its directors were recruited from the ranks of faculty, and that few of them had much, if any, administrative or management experience. NSF subsequently sent a mailing to selected individuals suggesting that directors of academic computing needed a training seminar. Although a formal program did not ensue, three individuals decided to initiate a program on a self-supporting basis. Bob Gillespie, then a member of the University of Washington Computer Science Department and director of the Academic Computing Center, Rex Krueger, director of computing at the University of Colorado, and the late Claire Maple, professor of mathematics and director of the Computation Center at Iowa State University. Bob, Rex, and Claire assembled a list of invitees and drafted a program. 43 academic computing professionals attended the first seminar held in 1970. Early on, SAC established itself as the place for those involved in academic computing to meet and discuss common issues. SAC evolved well beyond the technologies of computing and communications to deal with all aspects of the Computing Center director's leadership role in management, administration, fundraising, planning, application development, and other matters pertaining to the use of technology in supporting teaching, learning, and research. Most importantly, SAC was not about attending a seminar and being talked to, but about participatory dialogue. With this leadership award, we celebrate both an experience and the community of leaders who created it and whom it served. The EDUCAUSE Catalyst Award highlights IT-based innovations and initiatives that provide groundbreaking solutions to major challenges in higher education or change prevailing conditions in remarkable ways. In 2009, EDUCAUSE recognizes Federated Identity Management Systems, a far-reaching web of initiatives that has had broad impact on higher education and its partners in less than a decade. Identity management refers to the procedures and tools that establish user identities and enforce rules about access those users have to digital resources in a networked environment. As a means to streamline the availability of digital resources and to protect intellectual property, identity management serves both as a facilitator of access and a primary tool for security, both of digital resources and of user privacy. Federated Identity Management endeavors to create independent authorities that multiple organizations can use to verify user identities based on common protocols and attributes. The ultimate goal of identity federation is to enable users of one domain to securely and seamlessly access data or systems of another domain. These services allow students, researchers, and staff to access online resources to which they are entitled, such as research data, online journals, virtual environments for information sharing, institutional repositories, online grant applications, and many other online resources. The developers of these systems pull together many strands of technology to create robust identity services that are critical for today's applications, as well as advancing cloud computing. The vision for federated identity came from multiple areas and generated collaborative efforts worldwide, which resulted in a critical service for higher education. This is yet another manifestation of the convergence of opportunity and need and demonstrates how higher education institutions share and learn from each other to benefit the entire community. Although many federated identity management organizations exist, we recognize several with this award as representative of those that manage federated identity systems worldwide. The InCommon Federation and the Internet 2 Middleware Initiative in the United States, JISC, the Joint Information Systems Committee in the United Kingdom, and Switch Federation in Switzerland. This award is an important recognition of the remarkable way that organizations have been able to employ federated identity to help manage the security of higher education's critical information. With this year's Catalyst Award, we celebrate both an important innovation and a significant new capability that now touches many institutions of higher education. The 2009 Leadership and Catalyst Award will be recognized at the EDUCAUSE 2009 annual meeting, and two featured sessions have been reserved for each of these awards. The Leadership Award featured session is on November the 5th, and George Strawn from NSF will be presenting Looking Back, Looking Forward, Trying to Use 48 Years in Academic IT to Predict Our IT Future. The Catalyst Award featured session, also on November the 5th, will feature a panel of representatives from each of the four awarding organizations, and the title of their session is Connections, Stories and Dreams of Federated Identity.
October is National Cybersecurity Awareness Month. As we rely more on technology-based solutions in our everyday lives, cybersecurity becomes everyone's responsibility. And the largest group of victims of identity theft is between the ages of 18 and 29. Students need to understand the risks and how to protect their personal information, computer, and campus networks. Therefore, we encourage you to consider ways you can raise awareness among your faculty, staff, and students, and invite you to help promote National Cybersecurity Awareness Month. The Higher Education Information Security Council and its partners recently held a national poster and video contest to help raise awareness of and increase computer security at colleges and universities. Consider using these new student-created posters and videos in your campus security awareness campaigns during October or throughout the year. For tips and suggestions, check out the Resource Kit for National Cybersecurity Awareness Month, developed by the Higher Education Information Security Council. Links to these resources and more can be found at www.educause.edu/security.
I am Joe Wheaton, and I am an associate professor at The Ohio State University. I am in the field of special education and rehabilitation services, and I also work closely with the Web Accessibility Center at The Ohio State University. Let's start kind of generally. A student with a disability who comes to the Ohio State University or any institution of higher learning, I think, they're going to come in knowing that they have a disability. I mean, they didn't wake up in the morning and say, oh, I have a learning disability. Ideally, they have transitioned out of high school into higher education. And in their transition plan out of high school, they have been in contact with the university, they've been in contact with an office for disability services. Their main support is going to be that office for disability services. The students that we are going to see in higher education with the most common disability is going to be learning disabilities. And the things that they are going to use a lot of is extra time on exams seems to be the major thing I get asked for. Not all students with disabilities register with that office. For example, a person who uses a wheelchair, a person who has paraplegia can use their upper arm strength well. So they may not even bother registering with the Office for Disability Services, yet they have a very obvious disability. Where students with learning disabilities may choose to register even though they have a hidden disability and could, quote unquote, pass. All of us who work in accessibility believe that accessibility is for everyone. The idea is that when we generate accessible content, that content can be used not only by students with learning disabilities or visual impairments, but it can be also used by everybody. So if we have an audio copy of a book, that means that the same technology that is used in this podcast could be used to listen to the textbook. Students could, in theory, plug that in while they run on the treadmill, and they could do two things at once. I would think it would be a big selling point for publishers, but I would really like to have an interview with a publisher and find out what is happening there. We spend a lot of time doing awareness, trying to get people just, and I don't mean the administration, because they've got the legal mandate, they know about that. But I think it's getting people to apply that. Nobody out there is saying, there's no way I'm going to make my stuff accessible, because I don't like people with disabilities. And I think what people are saying is that I don't know what to do, and I can't invest the time. And so I think that my biggest frustration is to try to get people to recognize that when they make things accessible, they make them more usable for all of their students. What we want to do with people is to help them learn skills that make their lives easier and makes them more productive in the things they do of higher quality. And if there's an add-on to that that is going to be a major time commitment by them, they're going to be more reluctant to do that. But if we can show them how to do things that make their life easier and are accessible, I think we can get a lot more buy-in there. The example I use is styles in Microsoft Word. Almost everybody uses Microsoft Word as their word processing program. If they use styles, they can style their headings, structure their document, have it look consistent, and then if they have to change a style, they can do it quickly. Change it once, it goes throughout the document. The other advantage of that is that if they convert to a HTML document, a web document, just using the conversion program in Word, it maintains that structure. And when a person who's blind hits that page, they can navigate that page using that heading structure, and it essentially gives them a table of contents for a document. We have made that document much more accessible just by using styles in Word. That makes people's lives easier because once they master that skill, they can generate accessible content seamlessly. That's the way we're going to get things accessible. We have been looking at open source assistive technology that's free. And we have identified screen reader technology, several really interesting add-ons to the Firefox browser. FireVox, that's Fire V-O-X, is a web page reader. That's a very powerful web page reader from Charles Chen. So there's a lot of things. And frankly, I'm amazed at the things that people are developing and putting in large amounts of time and putting these things up on the web for essentially for free. There's a lot of open source stuff, and I would encourage anybody who has a need for, especially reading text, there's a lot of stuff out there. There are several programs that can be very useful to web developers for testing their pages, looking at their pages. There's a functional accessibility evaluator that comes out of the University of Illinois, a very nice program for looking at your pages. Not only does it comply with the standards that come out of the Web Accessibility Initiative from the World Wide Web Consortium, but also the functionality of the page. Not only can you just check off a box and say, yeah, there, that's accessible because the validator said it was, but the Functional Accessibility Evaluator is trying to determine, can a person actually use this page? Those are all things that, as a web developer, can be very helpful for people developing accessible web content.
Thanks for joining us. If you'd like to find out more about the stories and interviews you heard, check out our show notes at www.educause.edu/now.
And October is Cybersecurity Awareness Month. Be sure to look for EDUCAUSE Now next month when we'll talk to the National Cybersecurity Alliance about some of their new initiatives in reaching college and university students regarding security and their use of social networks.
I'm Colleen Luckett for EDUCAUSE Now.
And I'm Jerry Bain. Thanks for listening.